Welcome to a special Pause for the Cause episode with Cal Byer from Safe Project.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right. Welcome to a really special episode with a really special guest. I'm actually going to start and just say hi to Nathan. Nathan, how are you doing this morning?
Oh, man, I am jazzed up. Got a couple coffees in me, ready to go with our Energizer Bunny here, Cal Byer.
Yeah, right. And as Nathan just introduced, it's Cal Byer. Cal, thanks for sitting down with us today, man.
Jeff, any time for you and Nathan. Still can't believe when you first introduced me to Nathan, we could finish each other's sentences. And you were the critical link right there. And you guys continue to inspire me with the great work you do. And Jeff, thanks for just making time on really important topics.
Well, I thank you and thank you. So everyone listening, so you guys know, like the impetus for what we now know as Pause for the Cause was brought to us by Cal. Cal introduced the ConTech Crew years ago to the CIASP, the Construction Industry Alliance for Suicide Prevention, or a mouthful for we got to do better. And that we do have a problem and bringing this to the forefront. And we took it, I took it when I took over the show as more moving for Pause for the Cause, ultimately so we could expand beyond that and into new things, which is what brought us back together to sit down and talk, because Nathan saw Cal recently at the CFMA where Cal's, you've done a ton of great work and I think have really impacted the industry through another fabric that we know is so large in CFMA. So Cal, give the folks who may have not heard our older episodes, and you can go back and listen to them, but let's listen to it in Cal's words. Like, talk to us about your, you know, what brought you here, and then, you know, where we see this evolving, this matrix of what we're trying to produce and create.
Well, Jeff, I remember intently that first podcast that we did. It was a live broadcast, if I recall correctly. It was my first experience with the ConTech Trio, and it was before the CIASP had even formed. It would have been July of 2016, as I recall, and the CIASP was formed in October of that year. But I'd been partnering with Dr. Sally Spencer Thomas. I brought her as a behavioral health specialist. I felt like it was time for our industry to launch a mental health and suicide prevention initiative. I'd gone to work for a paving contractor in the Pacific Northwest with a vision of doing that. And that company allowed me to bake mental health and suicide prevention into our safety and risk culture. And we did a lot beyond that, but those were the premises. It was all part of human capital risk management. Take care of the people and they'll take care of your business. And I'm so proud to see how our industry has responded. It's now 10 years since we formally launched this mental health and suicide prevention initiative. And to see almost every association, almost every labor union, so many collaborations within our industry embrace this topic in various forms, it's just showing that we are making an impact and showing people that help is available. And we're able to truly use words like hope, help, healing, and recovery. We've been able to fill in a lot of those gaps and get help for people in real time. It's really been exciting.
Yeah, that 2016 episode was still the trio, and it was it was you and the guys, and I was a listener at that point. Right, the first time we met was live at CFMA in the Fontainebleau lobby, live again. You, James, and I sitting down at a table and you know, doing those live broadcasts, and just I was instantly drawn to the mission, the conversation, just the vulnerability, all of those things encapsulated in a way that it was real. Like it wasn't some of these things are too high, too low. You know, they're not enough or they're too much. It's too over the top. Cal, you brought this really digestible, really approachable piece to the story. And so I'm interested. You started it there at a contractor, really about human capital and risk management, really through your own lived experiences. But you're progressing like everything. You're continuing to progress. So talk to me about, you know, how you got from human capital risk management, you know, to where we are today and what you're doing today.
On March 15th of this year, I joined a national nonprofit called SAFE Project. It stands for Stop the Addiction Fatality Epidemic. You guys have known I've been continuously moving upstream to address the root causes that, if left unresolved, could result in suicide. Sadly, we needed to use the suicide crisis to get people more comfortable about talking about mental health. And now, through some great leaders, we've really put the focus more on wellness, physical health, and the intersection with emotional health. And then your friend, our friend, Rob McKinney, and his focus on mental fitness. We've taken this stigma away when we focus on this as a strength, and we focus on the prevention and recognize that the human body and brain is going to be fatigued. It's going to get tired. We're going to have periods of up cycles and down cycles, and we need to learn how to better manage those stressors and develop coping skills and strategies and learn new techniques to connect with people and to let people know I'm not okay. And that's all happening. But the one burning need that has been hard to address has been substance use, substance misuse, substance use disorder, addiction, treatment and recovery, and the overdose crisis. So I'd been partnering for about 3 years with SAFE Project as a nonprofit that I knew, came to trust, deeply respect. In some ways, it's like a vertically integrated nonprofit. So there is a senior director of SAFE veterans and caregivers, SAFE communities, SAFE choices for K-12 schools, SAFE campuses, and then SAFE Workplaces. I'm the senior director for SAFE Workplaces. And just in the 3 months I've been there, to be able to collaborate between each of those portfolios with the other senior directors, we're able to show this as a comprehensive solution-based approach and to tackle the really tough issues that are systemic, that have barriers that keep people from getting help. So Jeff and Nathan, you know, in the work I've done, it's been hard to get a lot of articles written about substance use and substance use disorder. Up until the pandemic, we could write about drug testing. We could write about drug-free workplace policies. But with the onset of the pandemic, several publications agreed that we should do more, that we should be emphasizing the prevention side, teaching people the limitations of drug-free workplace programs and the limitations of drug testing programs, and to share more resources with employees and their families about substance misuse, and then giving them gateways for recovery through treatment programs. So it's come full circle, and I needed to do this. It just became irrefutable that this was the next move in driving this forward. And if we could teach the army of helpers that we built around mental health, mental fitness, suicide prevention, teach them about addiction, treatment, and recovery, we could impact hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people.
Talk about literally coming full circle. I mean, I can almost see that kind of like three-legged stool of the suicide prevention on one end, the mental health and how that ties in, and then this whole substance use and misuse. And all three of them kind of have their own stigmas that you've just been such a champion for just taking and just stabbing in the heart and making us talk about it and helping us get comfortable with it. And it really is kind of that final leg of the stool to really understand that it is all about people. People are different. They react in different ways and everyone is different, but that there are correlations between these three things that happen and we can learn from it.
Yes. And those correlations exist as co-occurring disorders. So substance use disorder is a complex, treatable chronic health condition. It's a disease, and it co-occurs with mental health diagnoses, and it contributes to that lack of mental fitness because we get tired, we get fatigued, we're self-medicating, right? And it starts that vicious cycle. That can contribute then to musculoskeletal challenges, which makes us more vulnerable to a injury both on and off the job, which gives us susceptibility to being prescribed opioids, which could further an underlying substance use disorder or create a new one. So you guys are both systems thinkers, and I've always appreciated how you connect the dots before others see the dots. And it's been a powerful gift to know you and to be able to test some of my theories and ideas with you, because if you're getting it, I know you're going to help me communicate it. And so I've just been grateful for the friendship we have, and I admire the work you do and how you've leaned in to make this part of your work.
Well, thank you, Cal. And on that note, just because you made me think of it, it was interesting. I was recently at a physical therapy, and the 20-something-year-old PT therapist told me she was reading a recent study that I'll have to go find it now that I'm mentioning it. But it ultimately said that stress is held, again, as you said, in your body, and that women tend to hold their stress in their shoulders and men tend to hold their stress in their hips. And I thought that was really interesting because all of, again, my wife's issues are in her back and over her shoulder, especially her left, because she's left-handed. And a lot of my issues are all kind of in my hips and around that area. And we're obviously both very stressed because we have two small kids and hopefully enough excuses to be stressed. But regardless, I love when science can help explain these hunches or these things that happen and help us make sense of them. And also to help us, you know, be proactive and do something about them, right? Like that's the whole point of data and transparency, everything we normally talk about. This is it happening within this world, which I think is just such a cool synergy.
And for me, it's cool how this really did take root with my safety and risk management professionals. We recognize these human capital exposures were impacting people, and they spilled out onto job sites. They impacted productivity, quality, risk, safety, sequence, schedule, you know, even scope of work, right? Everything was impacted by these unspoken, hidden behavioral health challenges. And only when we talk about it can we recognize that people might need help, and then we can teach people how to seek and accept help. And then we can expand our platform for employee benefits, and we can teach people about community-based organizations that can offer help as well, both governmental, nonprofit, social service organizations. It can be more robust than only calling 988 or crisis text line. The toolbox used to be really small. We didn't have a lot of tools, and now more and more employers are really embracing more strategies to close some of those gaps.
Yeah, it was a pretty limited toolbox when this all started. And
yes, it was.
It's
a few wallet cards, a few hard hat stickers. We gravitated then toward posters. Yep. QR codes was a breakthrough when someone had that genius idea. Mm-hmm. And I do remember the first person that I recall testing that was Cabri Schmidt at then Hensel, now still at Hensel Phelps, but it was a project. And it's taken a lot of innovation, right? It's taken people to find new ways to communicate, to break through the barriers. You've seen the poker chips that have the 988 logo and crisis text line. I bet I've seen now close to 40 different organizations with their own version. Last week, I took 50 for the CIASP to the Executive Committee for the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention. People were so impressed with how this industry continues to push that outer envelope, right? The edge. That's where progress is made.
Well, and you know what Cal's doing there, Jeff? He's doing poke yoke. We learned a new lean term recently, but essentially making it easy for people to do the right thing is such a huge part of all of this. And it takes a lot of effort, right? It takes a lot of thoughtfulness. It takes a lot of, you know, brute force and effort to do all the effort that you're talking about to make it easy to do the right thing. And that's, yeah, just great examples of it.
Well, and to break down stigma, we had to not use clinical terms. We had to just use conversational terms. We had to let people know you can talk to someone. You can let them know you care. You can say things like, I care too much about you to not say something. Or, I know this is going to be awkward. It is for me too, but I care about you enough that I'm willing to risk it. Are you okay? And as we get bolder, more people start to share. And once someone has accepted help from someone else, they're so much more likely to offer help. So it becomes a peer-to-peer support network. And you can almost see the webbing on certain crews within certain divisions of certain companies where it's tangible. You can feel this caring culture. That's the biggest change I've seen over 8 years. Yeah, I'm sure we still have some people scoffing. Oh, bullshit. Just pull yourself up by the bootstraps, right? But I think the real issue is more people are accepting and understanding and supportive that this is a good thing and that people are getting help.
And I think you're right. I think it's really visible because the interesting thing is when they have that connection, when they have that caring atmosphere, they're more productive. They're healthier. It's safer, right? And the interesting thing is this whole pull yourself up by the bootstraps thing is almost counterintuitive if they think it through, because once OSHA came around and we hit a certain point in, say, the 70s and 80s in building, it was about safety. You were putting your life in the hands of those people that you work with. This is no different. It's a little more vulnerable, but this is how we can, and from a systems perspective, how we can connect. And like you said, it's something early on in our conversations, it's mind the gap between the question and the answer. Are you okay? Pause. Wait. Not how you doing? I'm expecting good and I'm going to roll on. It's mind that gap. It's there. And then I hadn't put this together, and Nathan was on this episode with me with Eitan Vesely, and Eitan invented a system called Water Cooler AI, which is supposed to help in predicting burnout across organizations. But the interesting part, Cal, that he talked about was he came from a computer systems background where there was redundancy and all of these things that he did to keep the systems up. And he had a moment in time where he went, wait a minute, why don't we do that for the humans? Like the actual people that are really, truly, because don't we say this all the time? Like our number one asset is our people. Yet we put all of this into our technology to make it available 24/7 all the time. But we're not putting the same redundancies, the same systems, the same supports in place for our people. I think it's really important because it's our people in the field. It's our people in the office. Like, everyone's just as vulnerable, especially because you don't know where that stress comes from. You know, Nathan, you did a good job of just saying, like, I hope we have the right to have stress. Everybody has the right to have stress. Everybody's life is difficult. There's nobody that's walking through life perfect. It's not true. It's not happening.
No. And stress is a normal response by the brain and the body to change or difficult circumstances. And if we can build resilience through mindfulness and through exercise, nutrition, hydration, feed the whole system, we can help offset some of these challenges. Some of the true stories that inspired me back in the early days, a gentleman named Kevin Hines, you'll recall 40 years ago, he survived a jump from the Golden Gate Bridge. and lived to tell about it. And it's a powerful story. I said 40, I meant 20 years ago. And just an incredibly powerful story. And he talks about setting boundaries. He talks about living with a diagnosis for mental health, but what he does to protect himself, what he does to nourish himself. Sleep is another restorative quality. So setting boundaries around that, and when he should be with people, when he should isolate and cocoon. Learning those limitations in each of us is a healthy strategy as well. I've been very intentional the last several years about increasing my sleep. And it did require some habit changes. It required me to stop focusing so much on work, get outdoors, spend more time with loved ones. Being intentional, right?
Cal, are you trying to say that you can actually say no to just one more beer? You're able to just go to bed? Because that's a tough thing to do. I don't know.
That is.
I have been able to before. I just say yes, and then I go an Irish accent and leave anyway.
Nathan, I would say
that's my strategy.
In the last 5 years, I really have been putting an emphasis on proper sleep. And that has been reducing intentionally any alcohol intake. And I can correlate better sleep on nights when I go to bed earlier and I'm not using my phone. And then if I have not had any alcohol, right? And so you start to see rewards.
Yeah, you start to see rewards. But I want to attack that at the core too, because there is a misnomer that taking that moment for yourself, making that change, consciously stepping away from work, consciously getting outside, spending time with your family. In our modern world, that is considered selfish. And that is just not, it might be true, but it's true in the positive sense of the term. It's true in the sense that when you're on the plane and they talk about the oxygen coming down, and who do you put it on first? Yourself. Why? So you can take care of everybody else.
Yes.
And so we've created this environment where, oh, you're selfish. You think about you first. That's actually in most respects a good thing when it's about self-care.
Yeah, self-care shouldn't be viewed as an indulgence or a luxury, right? We should view it as a normal part of our daily existence for the reasons that you just gave. I would say, if anything, historically, I'd gone over and above, like over the top and above board. And I ran the risk of burning out. And a year ago, I was in a tough spot. I traveled way more frequently than I'd done since the onset of the pandemic. Travel had increased by about 50%. And it came to a point where people were checking in regularly. That's how I knew who my friends were. Who really was noticing? Are you really okay? Dude, you need to settle down. Stop traveling. And it took a while to get off that hamster wheel. And I remember taking a 3-week vacation and just unplugging. And all I really did was clean out my inbox of the junk mail. Didn't really do work. I let people know 6 weeks in advance, I'm going to be off the grid for almost 3 weeks. It was cathartic. So it was very, very healthy. Was it selfish? Yes. My wife of 35 years appreciated it. My children noticed that dad was more present. I was more engaged in personal conversations. And ultimately, my friends were right. I was more effective in the help I was giving people. I was able to stay calm. I'd become a little more intense. I'd become a little more agitated, a little more wound up. And that kept people from reaching out to me because they sensed that I was at a breaking point. So I had to admit that. I had to acknowledge, call it out. Hey, you got to take care of yourself too. I didn't practice what I teach for about that 5 or 6 months. I still appreciate the friends calling me, but I'm like, you guys have no idea how different it is. But it shows this is a continuous battle, right? And to find that life-work balance. 25 years ago, I would have called it work-life balance. But now I'm really trying to put the life before the work, because to do my best work, I have to be living my best life. So I agree with what both of you have said.
I'm going to have to look this up, but I just had our last guest last week mentioned Jeff Bezos's comment that I think we all should start thinking about is it's, and I'm going to try and do this the right way, because I say work life too. So it's life work harmony, because balance doesn't take into account work's going to be a lot at times, right? Just because of the nature of the way it is, right? It's not like it's like, if we were in a production line, sure, we could balance that because we know what our production line does, but we're not, right? And we're in the people business. So it's going to ebb and flow, but there is a harmony that we need to achieve to create a sense of balance in our lives when honestly, it can't be a this or a that. So I'm going to try and take that one and call it a life work harmony. Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. In fact, I was so sold on Join that I joined the team as its industry evangelist. Many trade shows and podcasts later, Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built.
As soon as you started that story, I knew where you were going. And I've heard that, and it does make sense. And that idea of balance, maybe it never will be in balance, but can you be in harmony, right? Can they blend and have it be seamless so you can ebb and flow? I think that's the challenge that my generation, I'm a boomer, we only had one speed, right? It was work hard, get out of my way, I'm going to plow through it. There's no barrier that going to hold us back. And that idea of taking time for ourselves was a slow lesson, even for someone like me to embrace.
Well, and also the idea that work is not fun and fun is not work, kind of that, you know, I feel like hopefully a little bit the millennial and younger generation are trying to spin that a little bit, where a lot of times where I feel selfish is when I do take time to do work on work that I think is really enjoyable, but I do that by sacrificing family time. And then I feel guilty there. And so it's again, like this, I really like the idea of harmony as opposed to harmony. Balance, because harmony is really what is your harmony? And how does it work within those around you? And that balance assumes it has to be 50-50.
You guys are like these practical philosophers. You take these deep concepts and then you simply operationalize them. So I do always enjoy that. I'm going to take that away, Jeff. Like Nathan, I'm going to take that as a takeaway.
Maria Davidson, I got to thank her for it. It's just, it's the beauty of this medium we've created that has allowed us to connect to people, has allowed us to do a number of different things. Because, you know, we're a technology show on our usual week, but technology is all about amplifying human capabilities, but you know, many times not done in harmony. You know, many times it's done. I mean, I'll give Ryan Hoggett a little bit of a plug here again, is that we don't want humans to be operating at 100% productivity all the time. That is not a safe place. There is an optimal productivity yes. level that we should be looking for in our people. And this is where I want to draw and talk about what you're doing now, because as we look at SAFE, you guys are taking sort of I like this four-pronged approach with campuses, communities, workplaces, veterans. That's life, right? And to see that you guys at the top, I'm going to use a Nathan here when we talk about a CDX, a common data exchange. You guys are that human layer of exchange. So what we see on campuses, what we see on K-12, what we then see in the workplace, what we see after people serve or while they're serving, that's our society. That's how we're built. So you're connecting those like the symptoms to the sources, and then you got an opportunity to go at them in different places and meet them in different places.
Of all the nonprofits I partnered with, it was the one that I felt the closest alignment with because it was real. So Jeff, you used that word at the very beginning, but it was real. It was meeting people where they were at. And it was focused around wellness and well-being. And it was focused on being reproducible change in every one of those portfolios. I always viewed those as pillars, but I like this idea of a portfolio because you have many different stakeholders and constituents within each one of those pillars or platforms. So by calling it a portfolio, you recognize we have to be very nimble, very agile. We have to be very perceptive to build strategies that are going to work and to provide relief, to provide some tangible impact to the addiction fatality crisis. And that has been a real underlying issue of everything we've done in the construction industry. But we're not the only industry that struggles with this. But our industry, I predict, like we did with suicide, is going to be the industry that helps bring solutions to an energy and hope to others. And
I would love to know what manufacturing or automotive or any of the other kind of work intensive, but not construction, that have obviously gone through the opioid crisis, and what they're doing now, that, and what can construction maybe learn from them?
Yeah, Nathan, it's been hard to find leaders in other industries who've been as vulnerable as we have that acknowledge the challenges that we face.
Wow.
So other industries were not as adversely impacted and for as long as construction. So this is a topic that I've been teaching a lot on over the last multiple years. I've been titling it a call to action on opioids in the workplace and teaching people, leading gateways for opioid persistent use. And then really focusing on the overdose prevention. And last March of 2023, naloxone, the opioid reversal medication, was approved for over-the-counter use. So it became easier to obtain. What I really appreciate is we are doing a call to action on naloxone in the workplace and on job sites. And there has been some resistance that having naloxone on a job site could give the perception that doing active drug use on jobs might be acceptable, or it might be condoning that. But there is a reality. 9.5% of all occupational fatalities are attributable to unintentional overdose of substances. That has grown over the last 10 years, so 10 consecutive years. So companies that are embracing the need for naloxone recognize this is about life safety. And it's about saving lives. And a risk management approach that would be responsible would be being prepared for the potential or the inevitable. With 9.5% of workplace fatalities being an overdose, you're more likely to need naloxone today than many other life safety events or devices we have on job sites. So we've seen how prevalent the AED has become, that automated external defibrillator. Yeah. We need to consider Narcan as a staple in every first aid kit in the workplace and on job sites. And so if you just play this scenario, what happens if you're not prepared, you haven't provided training, you don't have Narcan on a job site, versus if you have been prepared, provided training, and have Narcan on site? So if someone drops, it looks like a medical emergency, you do a quick assessment. if it's an overdose and you're not prepared with Narcan, you've made the call to 911 and now you're in a wait and see game. Unless someone else, a bystander, happens to have Narcan because they've had a need for it or recognize the need for it, that wait is going to be forever. So hypoxia, brain damage and brain death, can occur in as quick as 4 minutes. Those emergency medical responses could be longer. So even if someone did start first aid CPR, that will have limited utility where you don't have the naloxone. So what happens is, in that scenario, you've got first responders on site. Most likely you'll have law enforcement. If there is a fatality on site, you're likely to have a coroner. You'll have a body on site while an investigation is being done. All other workers are distracted and upset by what they've seen. And they're going to wonder, why didn't the company have naloxone for something that's been pretty predictable, right? You might even have OSHA in some jurisdictions coming on site to conduct an investigation. At minimum, a half a day. But that's going to linger on that job site. People are going to be asking questions. They're going to be wondering. There'll be blame. There'll be negativity.
Yeah. I kind of look at it like that. I'm glad you brought up the AED because that's right where I went. I mean, I remember when the AEDs were just coming out and they approached Gallegos where I was working and all of our eyes went like, oh, you want to put one on the outside of our building and wow. And it's not like any of us went, people should eat better and not have heart disease. It's like,
it is addressing a symptom for sure. As is Narcan, right? But that doesn't mean it's a problem. Yeah, like it's still needed. It's a yes and, right?
Well, and that's the interesting thing too, Cal, is like the one thing about the AEDs that's so important is that they're discoverable too.
Yes.
Right? Is that they're discoverable. So it would be nice to see Narcan and Narcan stations discoverable as well. And we all know this, like we learn certain skills at work that then we can take home and you know, they might come in handy in our lives. Like we have to look at the opioid epidemic. We have to look at the overdose epidemic with things like fentanyl and other things that are entering. There's new ones coming that are stronger than fentanyl that an accidental interaction with can kill you unless you have access to or knowledge of where those things are. And also, socialization and understanding of how it works and reducing the stigmas around what it is.
Love the way you guys operationalize and articulate your knowledge. But what I would say is everything you said is true. The challenges that we face, there was no data for suicide until July of 2016. We'd been working on this before 2010. We started the construction subcommittee for the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention in 2012. 2014 is when Sally and I started rallying and lobbying. I went to work for the contractor in 2014 with that vision, approached CFMA in 15, and then CIASP in 2016. When that data came out, I was telling people, my biggest fear has just been confirmed. As bad as suicide is, I think we're going to be clobbered as an industry on opioids because of the musculoskeletal injuries. And that's been proven in multiple research studies. And our industry, sadly, does have the highest rate of overdose death among 20 major industries. So the data for construction alone per 100,000 workers is 130.9. people. So 130.9 construction workers per 100,000. You compare that to a suicide rate of 56. Now in extraction, that would be the mining industry, oil and gas, but it includes surface mining and dredging, which are important construction type operations. The suicide rate is 72. The overdose rate is only, and I say only with air quotes, 60.9. But you have more automation in mining, and that's likely a factor. You've got bigger buckets on bigger machinery. You've got conveyor systems. You've got rock crushers. In construction, we've got the human body doing lifting, twisting, turning, carrying, bending. All the contortions our bodies face, and the body will break down. So the first and most important opioid risk reduction strategy is injury prevention. And we can do that through warm-up exercise programs. I'm excited to see how many companies are now interested in fatigue management. And it's fatigue from overtime. More companies are talking about or have now established a maximum number of hours to be worked in a week and doing variance reports if there's a number that exceeds that maximum. And there's a recognition now that many companies are seeing the workers don't mind overtime if it's scheduled. The unscheduled overtime is when they can't control that harmony between their work and family lives. But it doesn't give enough time for recovery of the body and the brain. So it does cause stress, emotional, mental, physical, cognitive stress, where thinking isn't even clear, right? And we've all seen the signs of that.
And if there were to be a perfect storm case study for that, you know, like a data center is a great example of something where like you could throw so much money at it to build it, you know, you couldn't build it fast enough, right? So they'll run 3 8-hour shifts, you know, go 24 hours a day, but you can't have one person run all three shifts, right? Like you have to be able to hand things off. And so what is a strategy that takes care of mental health, takes care of process optimization, you know, can cater to all those things? Like, you know, to me, those become the fascinating problems where you're actually at the intersection of this lean stuff and the whole human behavioral, you know, taking care of yourself and needing to make money at the end of the day too. Because, you know, most projects would just say, that's fine, we'll wait longer. But, you know, data centers, other kind of mission critical things, like, you know, they can afford it.
Well, and the good news about the data too, being a systems thinker is now we have a benchmark to show how our improvements are working. And I believe some of the, I'll call it symptoms addressing, Narcan, et cetera, will help bring a little down. But as we see with everything, if we go to the source, so we start working on those. I mean, look, stretch and flex, it used to, people would laugh. And now, I mean, you see major job sites with the whole group out there stretching, flexing and starting to think about it. But we're also starting to see, you know, people augmentation when it comes to things like the Hilti devices that you strap on that help with repetitive work. We've seen a ton of this. We can't get bigger buckets like mining, but mining figured out they needed to do that. Our robotics is going to be something, you know, augmenting that's going to help us. This provides also an avenue to show an impact over time and an improvement. So much we measure our improvement on some level of productivity, some level of doing it faster. It's like, how about we do it? And we did this with safety. We do it safer. How about we do it better overall, more sustainable for our people? And ultimately, you hit this at the earliest, Cal. Human capital and risk management is good for the company. You know, we got to tie it back to dollars. And this is your investment in your future, is the safety and prevention of these types of things for your employees, for our workers.
Jeff and Nathan, I'm at an employee benefit conference in Washington, D.C. this week. And it's been the last frontier where we need to have more systemic change in the healthcare system, whether it's employer-sponsored or union-sponsored health plans. So I'm having a lot of conversations with employers in different industries. And again, there isn't a critical mass of people saying, hey, we could do this differently. We could do that differently. But the one common challenge I've seen is behavioral health is impacting everyone's costs on their health plans. I'm happy to say construction is at least addressing these topics. And what I really expect to see will be more interest in sharing information about addiction treatment and recovery, and then really tackling issues like naloxone on job sites and in the workplace. So it's hard, right? When you're a systems thinker, when you're just treating symptoms. But I get excited when I see action, because that usually leads to breakthrough solutions, and then it leads to more adoption. And then we get the spread of people innovating, much like we talked earlier about the toolkit for suicide prevention was very small at the very beginning. Wallet cards, a couple of hard hat stickers, and then it just kept evolving. We will see that on this addiction treatment and recovery side. And one of those innovations looks like peer-to-peer support. And if anyone's looking for a real bold example, the Building Trades Recovery Week in New England is huge. Started in 2019. It continued even through the pandemic. It's just grown. It's even been in New York. It's covering all of New England. And recently, there was a kickoff meeting to do something similar in Las Vegas. When that movement takes foot with employers, associations, and labor, or workers, it's going to be real. And that's where lives will be saved. So I'm excited to see all these trends. They still are developing, emerging. But within a few years, I think we'll have this convergence, much like we had with suicide prevention. And we'll look back and say, it wasn't that vexing. It just took some concentrated effort. And it's leaders like you that help spread the word. And then it's leading companies that are like, we care too much about our people to not do the tough things.
All right, Cal, I'm going to put one last bug in your ear before we go, because I wrote this down and I hadn't thought about this before. So what if the future of measuring workplace health, or kind of the health of the job that you do, is looking at the ratio of your cognitive versus operational versus mechanical tasks? A mechanical task being something that physically impacts your body and ultimately leads you to pain and hurt. Operational, something that's boring, but necessary in sort of the supply chain of how you do things, and needed. And then cognitive, where you actually have to make a decision, like something comes up. And so maybe you're in charge of something operational, but when you hit a snag, you have to go to someone else for the cognitive. But can you be the one that takes care of that cognitive, so you kind of feel more of that worth and that purpose, the autonomy, mastery, purpose that Daniel Pink talks about? So I'll leave everyone, you know, because we always got to end these on a high note, maybe that can be a way of measuring individuals and how much they're getting enjoyment and productivity out of their jobs as machines slowly take over the world.
Slowly but surely, right? And I do see that with the automation, for sure.
I feel you that exists out there, but we've done this a lot of times. We've augmented ourselves and we just rise up and do new things. My interest here is that, and I think we saw this with suicide prevention as well. I think we saw this with safety as well. Is that we'll see this with, the use disorder, is that companies will initially be spending a lot of money on the symptom and Narcan, et cetera. And they're business people. They realize, just like we're realizing with suicide and mental health, that a dollar spent to prevention is worth thousands of dollars to the symptom. So we move from treating the symptom to treating the problem, because it makes good financial sense. It makes good business sense. So I feel like that's exactly where we are with this. That's why Rob is out there with mental fitness and others are out there with mental fitness right now. And there's investment in the industry from that perspective, because, you know, it's proven financially and systematically that money in the beginning goes longer. That's why, you know, we want to see these kinds of programs grow. And I think you're right. I think that's where we'll look back and go, this was the moment in time when we realized we need to start throwing good money at good places, and let's throw it at earlier. Let's monitor what's going on. Let's do those things that we need to do so we can measurably have a long-term impact. So I think that's where we're headed. And Cal, I can't thank you enough for being you thank us, but to me, you're the leader. I every time I look and you're in a new place and you're spreading new words, new information, new data, you know, like you said, it came out in 2016, but you guys were working on that data before then. So we need people like you, but we also need investment. So one of the things I want to give you a moment to do is, you know, tell people where they can go find more about Safe Project, where they can invest in what you're doing, because again, investing there, their dollars are going to go farther.
So the website for Safe Project is safeproject.us. And you'll be able to find information readily available on that website. There are free resources, including Narcan training resources. I'd also like to give a quick shout out to a group that crowdsourced safety for Narcan on job sites. It's called the Alliance for Naloxone Safety in the Workplace. It was a construction group, answ.org. They also have a sample policy. They also developed a training program with an organization called MindForge. So I want to give a shout out there because there was some investment committed by those individuals. But it's a group that put together a very robust, frequently asked questions to take away the stigma, to empower and educate people about the importance of this topic. And it was launched with the same intention of the Construction Industry Alliance. Doing nothing doesn't work. How do we get started? So the gentleman who launched it was then at DPR. His name is Scott Kubicheski. He's been a friend and an early adopter of the suicide prevention. He's now at Lee's Crutcher Lewis up in Seattle. He called, asked me if I could help him after I shared some information with him about the Good Samaritan statutes in all 50 states and about naloxone access before it was available over the counter. And so the powerful thing is I said to him, I don't have the bandwidth right now. If I take on one more thing, my friends are going to clobber me, if not kill me. So Scott, let me find you 6 to 9 people. And within 2 or 3 weeks, 23 individuals emerged. And this idea of crowdsourcing is something that you guys would find really dynamic and exciting. And over the course of a year, they got a website up and running. And I always promote that as well, because I feel like I'm part of it. Safe Project was one of the early 23 founding members. But we recognize that we're part of the solution. We amplify best practices. We amplify good things. And that ANSW and the leaders involved, I just want to give them a shout out for taking a stand. And the National Safety Council is another organization that's been involved with opioid risk reduction for many years. They've got a substance misuse cost calculator. Nathan, you saw, I incorporated that into my presentation with CFMA. So I think what's powerful, we have a no shame pledge movement. And I believe almost 55,000 individuals have signed that pledge. And online, there's a QR code. You can scan it, enter in your information, and then send yourself a PDF that you can print. And then please, if you take the No Shame Pledge, would you post it on your social media, amplify the effort? And almost every time I talk to someone about Safe Project, I hear from 2 or 3 people immediately, how do I get involved? We have a director of volunteer programs. We're currently doing a naloxone accessibility challenge, going into local pharmacies, seeing if they're stocking naloxone. It's a simple survey. It's fascinating to have these conversations with the pharmacists and the pharmacy techs. It's giving people a lot of hope to see how prevalent naloxone has become. So I got to do a survey yesterday in a pharmacy here in Washington, D.C., just on a street corner. And it was the first time I'd seen a generic version of naloxone in a Walgreens side by side the commercially available Narcan. And it's showing us that society is responding, that we are seeing that every life is worth saving, and that this is something that we can tackle and that we're bigger than the opioid crisis. And so that's what gives me hope every day. So again, thank you for this opportunity to join you guys. Keep doing what you do. Shine your light bright. You've been a huge inspiration for me.
Well, wow. I know I speak for Nathan when I say vice versa, my friend.
Right.
And it has been a fantastic journey. So we appreciate you. I can't thank you enough, Cal, for sitting down today. And if you guys are, you know, if what he said touched you, reach out, connect. It's important. Nathan, thank you, my friend, for sitting down again.
I'm so glad this came together. Thank you, Cal. This was fun. I really enjoyed the conversation. I learned a lot.
Thanks so much, Nathan, for connecting you, me, and Jeff.
Thank you for tuning in today for our Pause for the Cause interview with Cal Beyer. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to the show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is The Content Crew, signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.